We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
The baseball season is go, go, go. It's nonstop, relentless for every night, six straight months, and then hopefully another month in October. You also have work, friends, family, and a million other things going on. That's when you reach for a Coors Light. It's made to chill. There's only one beer out there that's literally made to chill, and that's Coors Light. I mean, the mountains on the bottles and cans even turn blue when your beer is cold. Is there anything better than opening up your refrigerator after a long day, seeing that icy cold Coors Light can or bottle in your fridge? The answer is no, there's nothing better. That's why when it's time to chill, you choose Coors Light. It's mountain cold refreshment made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So that's why when you want to hit reset, reach for a beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado. And as always, celebrate.
We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your hosts, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 400. Today's show is brought to you by Untuck It. Scott, we made it to the 400 Club. Congratulations. Do we now get into the Hall of Fame like players used to get into the Hall of Fame when they hit 400 home runs? Or is podcasting now like the steroid era or the juice ball era, and everyone's hitting 400 home runs and it's no longer meaningful?
Yeah, because people are doing like 20-minute episodes. So if you could do a 20-minute episode and you get to 400, it's like, what are we doing here? It's not the same type of thing. Our episodes, almost every single one of them, and there have been many episodes that we actually don't even number. So actually, we've done more than 400.
Back and numbered them all.
Now, if you want to get technical, there's definitely more than 400.
We could have recorded our 400th episode like 3 weeks ago and not even known it.
It could have happened, but you got to celebrate. It's like it's like celebrating St. Patrick's Day on the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day, as we are going to do in spring training. You got to do it when you have an opportunity to do it. So this is 400 as far as everyone else is concerned, as far as we're concerned. And yeah, no, I think it's some people are getting like, you know, they're getting here too easily, too quickly by recording fast episodes, quick episodes, and that's fine. So
yeah, there's also like 550,000 podcasts out there now. Like my grandma just announced she has a podcast now.
Congratulations. Yeah. Does she need help getting into the new and noteworthy?
Yeah, probably. All right, so we are recording Friday afternoon because I'm leaving for my honeymoon on Saturday morning. So it's a couple days in advance that we're recording this. So if the world falls apart between now and Monday and we don't talk about it, you'll understand why. But if some news happens for the Yankees and there's a lot of arbitration news that's kind of trickling out on Friday afternoon. So we're going to sort of talk about our current thoughts on the arbitration stuff. But if more firm details are announced, Scott, you'll jump on and just acknowledge it. And
you know,
yeah, mention. And at this point, just so everybody knows kind of where we are just talking about this, at this point, Mookie Betts just signed a record deal for arbitration. What was the number? 27?
27 million of record. He has set records now 2 years in a row for the years that he specifically signed in. He signed 20 million in his year two. That was a year two record. And now he broke Nolan Arenado's record in year three. He signed for $27 million. And I think that it is an important thing to note if you're the Yankees, because there's really close ties with Judge and what he, I think, will be looking for in arbitration. So
we'll talk about all that. Yeah. I think giving people a bar as far as where the news is so they understand what we're talking about.
Gotcha.
As with the information that we have. So, and I think Urshela is the only Yankee that has come out so far as we're recording.
Yes. Yeah. So a couple quick housekeeping items before we do dive into all of that. The spring training event, March 14th, May 9th is the first regular season event against the Red Sox. People, I know everyone's asking about when are those going to be going up on the site. They're going to be up on the site. I'm going to hold you
to it. They're up on the site. They were up on the site. I'm having a site glitch and I'm fixing it right now. So I'm hopeful that they'll be back up today. Today's Friday. So by the time you're listening to this, they'll definitely be up.
So you can go now on the fan shop to the game events and you can get your tickets for May 9th against the Red Sox, Friday, June 26th against the Cubs, and Saturday, August 22nd against the Blue Jays. There is an update here. We had mentioned in the past we were going to do a July Red Sox game. That is no longer happening due to the times that MLB and the Yankees have decided that game is. It's a 1 o'clock in the afternoon game on the Saturday before the trade deadline. I don't know why they wouldn't put that in prime time, either 4 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the afternoon. But hey, it's going to be Saturday afternoon in the Bronx in late July. My guess on the temperature over under, Scott, 97.8 degrees.
Yeah, it's going to be hot too, but like that's not the whole part of it as well. Like we try to, a lot of the reasons why we try to do these events, obviously they're fun. It's good to get together with everybody. That's the number one reason, this community. But we always try to give a deal for all this stuff too. And when you're talking about a 1 o'clock game on a Saturday, the Saturday is great because they were able to give us tickets, but it was an expensive ticket. There really wasn't much of a break that we could get on it. So,
and 1 o'clock is early to get to the stadium. Plus
yeah, we
have
couldn't
a
really
pre-game
do a pregame
party beforehand. Most of the times we do have other 1 o'clock games, like the Blue Jays event on the 22nd of August is a 1 o'clock game. And we've done 1 o'clock games in the past, and the pregame is just not as fun. It's just not as crowded.
I mean, it's good. We're going to do breakfast beers for that one. So that one's going to be very good. We're going to set up something for it, but doing the one in July was just the logistics didn't work for what we were trying to do. So we're going to add another game, or we're looking at another game. And then also Saturday, June 13th is the Trenton event. That one will be up. It hasn't been up on the site yet because we're still working out some details with those guys. I have cleared most of it up. I actually spoke with them. I got an email from them yesterday, and we're going to put that one up too. So that will be up there as well. That's a June 13th. Event at the Trenton Thunder game. That's going to be a little different. It's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of interaction with the game itself. Like
never been
going
to a double A game.
Yeah, and doing stuff like on the field. Like everybody is going to be eligible for some of those some of the games and stuff too. Which is
you might pinch hit.
Yeah, you might pinch hit if you come to that game. You might pinch hit. But we're going to set up like a meet and greet with Rookie the dog. We're going to do a big picture on the field after the game. Everybody's able to get on the field and take a big picture. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be very different than our other ones. We're going to be tailgating in the parking lot. So a lot of cool things going with that one. And the price point is going to be really nice for that one too.
Other things, George's Box season 2. I was on the first episode of season 2. Nick Kirby was on the second episode that came out on Wednesday. Go give that a listen. And next week, JJ and Karen Veenstra, who is a writer on the website, will be doing that show next Wednesday. So make sure you guys are downloading and subscribing to George's Box. Anything else?
Oh, I think that's it.
So the arbitration stuff we just mentioned. The Yankees had 9 players who are eligible for arbitration. I'm just going to quickly run down the list and what they are estimated to get according to MLB trade rumors. Paxton is in his 4th year of arbitration. He's one of these special players that gets 4 years of arbitration. He's projected at $12.9 million. Tommy Canley, year 3 of arbitration, projected at $3 million. Gary Sanchez, first year, $5.6 million estimate. Judge, first year, $6.4 million estimate. Chad Green, first year, $1.4 million. Jordan Montgomery, first year, $1.2 million. Luis Sessa, first year, $1.1 million. Urshela, this is his first year. He ended up settling for $2.475 million, a couple hundred thousand dollars over what he was projected to get. And then Holder, first year, $800,000 estimate. And the one I really want to focus on is Judge. And we mentioned that the Mookie Betts news of $27 million, a record arbitration deal. And I do think that if you're Judge and you're Judge's agent, you're looking at the Mookie Betts deal and you're going to the Yankees and saying, look at what he just got. We're in this same ballpark. Maybe not equal because Betts has been more consistent than Judge. Did you agree with that?
Well, he's been on the field too. Yeah. I think
I mean, that counts.
Yeah, it absolutely counts. You have to look at the injuries.
So he's been more consistently healthy than Judge. But as far as like other measures, WAR, all the other statistics you can pull that these guys are pulling, and then when you factor in the face of the franchise, which factors? That's a conversation in these negotiations. The Yankees have made Judge the face of the franchise. In his rookie season, they went on a road trip and came back, and they built a friggin' section for him.
Which was very surprising, because the Yankees don't ever do that type of stuff. It was, a lot of people think it's gimmicky and all this. It was very gimmicky for the Yankees. The Yankees don't do gimmicky very, very often. So that was something that was a clear sign. Like, that's when you're looking back now and as an arbitration case, you're looking back like, damn it, why did that is that that section in right field is going to cost us millions of dollars.
Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. It definitely is.
It's a line
is.
In the sand saying this is what we're doing for this guy that's different than we've done it for anybody else. So yeah, it's actually a piece of evidence that the Judge's team could certainly use. But
yeah, so Mookie Betts is that he's a right fielder in the AL East, and he's been one of the best players in baseball for years at this point. And he is a centerpiece of a team kind of player. All of those things apply to Aaron Judge.
And you look at there's a rivalry here. Obviously, the Yankees and the Red Sox are big rivals, in case anybody didn't know that. But not just on the field, it's off the field. That is a consideration. There are optics here. The Red Sox are paying their player a record deal. And when judges come into the table, and you have to look back, if you start looking back again, by the time you guys are listening to this, these numbers are already out. So
Judge will have either settled with the Yankees.
We're either on or way off.
Or they're going to arbitration, which
I don't want to happen. But what we're looking at, yeah. And what we're looking at, though, is I think like right now at this point, we're looking at what could be used for the arbitration case. And if you're Judge, you're certainly, and your Judge's team, you're looking at what Mookie Betts got in that first year, and you're trying to line up to something very close to that. Again, precedent. Talked about this 100 times. It's very important when you're talking about contract negotiations. We saw that with Cole and Strasburg and what happened there. And then we saw, we've seen it with suspensions and contracts, and you see it with arbitration. So it's used all across baseball for their labor agreements and for contracts and just different things like this. So when you're talking about a number, I know MLB Trade Rumors has him at 6.4. But Mookie Betts got what? What we say?
10.5 year one, 20 year two, and now 27 year three. So he's got, what is that? Do some quick math. $57.5 million in his 3 years of arbitration.
Yeah, it's a lot. But look at year one, and there's a $4 million difference there between the projected and what Mookie Betts got. So I got to believe that gap's going to be much closer. And they're going to use that 10.5. And, maybe it's not going to be over 10.5. Maybe it will be, but maybe it won't be because of the considerations of health and things like that. But I think it's going to be damn close.
I think it's going to be close. I think it's going to be very close to $10 million in year one, which then sets up Judge for $20 million in year two. And then potentially $30 million in year three.
Honestly, this is working out beautifully. The fact that Mookie Betts is blazing this trail, and how close their situations are, and the fact that they are rivalries, it's so good for Aaron Judge to have a guy like that blazing the trail, because it's pretty much a clear case of 1-to-1.
And it's also if you're rooting for an Aaron Judge contract extension and bought out years of arbitration, it's good that Mookie Betts is going through this now, because the Yankees are looking and saying, wow, the Red Sox just paid $57.5 million for 3 years of arbitration and then might not even get to sign him long term, because there's talks that the the Red Sox are not going to be able to sign Mookie Betts for one reason or another. Are the Yankees going to want to pay $50 to $60 million to Judge for 3 years of arbitration only to have to then pay him when he hits free agency? No.
Well, I mean, it depends on you got to have willing participants in order to sign those extensions, but Judge is seeing what's happening here, and he's realizing that there's a lot of money to be made on a yearly basis. Problem with him, though, and I could definitely see this happening if I'm Aaron Judge and his team, you got to consider the fact that you could get injured. If you're on that side, you have to be looking at also the option to be safer rather than going for, you know, the max dollars and being that guy who turns out every single year for arbitration and gets that bigger contract. If you're if you have an opportunity to lock in guaranteed money for over the years, and we've seen that now with a lot of these guys, but when you're talking about a superstar guy like this and a guy that's been prone to some injuries, well, if I'm him, I'm really considering coming to the negotiation table and talking to the Yankees about a multi-year extension and really getting something locked in. Because to me, it seems like, and I know there's more potential for Judge to be made, money to be made on his end if he performs and stays healthy. I think the onus is on him to make more money, and he would. But again, there's no fail-safe for him getting injured because that's a very good, very real possibility for him.
If I had to guess, if there will be a contract extension, I think it'll happen before year two of arbitration. Because year one, if he makes around $10 million, that's still a bargain for Aaron Judge.
Yeah.
So the Yankees are saying to themselves, okay, yes, he's making more than he was the year before, but $10 million for an Aaron Judge caliber player is still a deal. And we are going to see where he is health-wise after next season. And if he stays healthy and produces, then he will get $20 million in arbitration year two. Then it becomes, okay, that's a lot AAV. That's what he's going to get on a long-term basis, AAV, a little bit more than that. So now it makes sense to buy out the years, give him an extension that maybe he takes a little bit less. We have to give a little bit more. And you meet in the middle somewhere on that long-term extension. I think year two is when it happens, if it does happen.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's a good area. I could see the other side of this now, too. If I'm Aaron Judge, and that is the route that I think I'm going to be taking, and who knows, there's a lot of considerations in this, you could feasibly and theoretically walk into a negotiation in your first year of arbitration and say, hey, I know you're getting a deal this right now, but if I'm paid more now, then you're also going to you're going to still make out on the back end of this contract and in further years. So if we start looking at, if I'm him, I may start looking at what Betts is getting right now and use that as a point of negotiation for what can happen, for a longer term contract, and know that 20 is going to be the bar for year two, 27 is the bar for year three, assuming it doesn't go up by then. And now you have leverage, I think, to actually go in and say, well, $10 million right now, you're getting a bargain. Let's go to the table and look at 5-6 years and maybe we could find something that's good for both of us. Because now Aaron Judge would get that money sooner and the Yankees would probably get a much bigger bargain on the back end.
Yeah, and I think that the Red Sox, there's been rumors that they're looking to offload Mookie Betts and David Price. I think this makes it harder now.
His number? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of teams would probably take it, and take it on because it's a short-term contract.
I think
contract.
You have to have some assurance that you're going to be able to sign them long-term because you're going to be giving up players.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's going to be very difficult for the Red Sox to not
that's
do
what I
a
mean.
Salary dump.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah, because you're not going to give up very many players. It would be a deal that would be similar to Giancarlo Stanton in the sense that you're not giving, you're it's all money. It's all about the money. Not about the prospects because there's no certainty. And in Stanton's case, it was a longer term contract than it was just a ton of money over a long period of time. So the Yankees were eating all of that. Whereas it's a similar risk in the sense that if you're a team and you can't pay that, you're losing the player. So you're not going to give up assets. In both cases, you're not going to give up many assets.
Yeah. I've also seen though that the Red Sox are trying to pair Price with Betts in a salary dump.
Yeah, that's interesting. We'll see what happens, man. That would be, talk about optics. That's a bad, bad optics right there. You get rid of the...
If he doesn't want to sign, though. If Betts doesn't want to sign in Boston, get something for him. From a business perspective and a non-emotional perspective, I get it. Because if he's just going to walk, you're going to offer him the qualifying offer. He's going to reject it and you get a draft pick.
Yep.
Is the draft pick more valuable than salary relief plus a mid-level prospect? I don't know.
Yeah, no, probably not, though, depending on where you're, I mean, you're going to be picking in an area where you're not going to get one of the top guys. So yeah, it's probably not going to be, we'll see. Thing is, when you're looking at a team like that, that's going to lose a potential superstar like Mookie Betts, you have another team that's in a similar position with Lindor. And now there's only certain teams that can actually absorb a guy like that and bring on that type of contract and that type of risk. And now you're looking around at one team. You're looking at the Dodgers and you're saying, hey guys,
the Angels might get dumb.
I feel Dodgers, like can you guys come back and bail us out again, please? Can you help us out again?
Well, they might. They didn't get any free agents.
Yeah, there's a very real possibility that that happens again. It's going to piss me off.
So World Series confirmed because the Yankees signed Chris Iannetta to a minor league deal as catcher depth. He is a veteran that you've probably heard his name a million times. He had some productive years, 2008 to 2014, but his last two seasons with Colorado, he's been thoroughly below average. So now this is two backup catchers, two veteran catcher pieces with Kratz and Iannetta that they've signed. Do you see one of those guys taking the backup job over Higgy? Or is this purely insurance for if Higgy's injured or Sanchez is injured or something like that?
Yeah, it's 1,000% insurance. Like, these guys are going to be down in the minor leagues and working in spring training, helping. And I would assume, I don't even know if both of them are going to be down there, but they will. It's absolutely insurance for in case Higgy doesn't work out or if there's an injury. You have a guy that knows what he's doing and can handle a staff. So I think that it's good for them in AAA to have a veteran guy like this. And you know, able to work with the younger guys and, you know, help them out as much as they can. It's kind of like another coach being on the field in AAA. So it's all positive. I think it's a good idea to do this. I was listening to an interview with Eric Kratz on Sirius Radio, MLB or whatever. And, he's just, you know, he's one of those guys that he understands where he is in his career. And he knows that he is that kind of that backup quarterback, you know, that's really just trying to help out the young kid. And if you're there for emergency situations, he's like, you know, the Vinny Testaverde that was there forever with the Jets, even though Vinny was the man and awesome when he came in, but he was there as a guy to help out and, you know, to be a tutor and to make sure that these guys are, you know, whether there's a young catcher underneath them to help them out, but more essentially to help out the young pitchers. I think it's very big for development.
I mean, Iannetta was in the majors though the last 2 years. I'm surprised he's taking a deal like this. I don't know.
Is
I don't
he
know.
37?
Yeah, 38? He's in his late 30s. I don't know the market for Iannetta. It's obviously not a lot, but
yeah, when you have an aging catcher that's not productive much anymore, then yeah, you're going to be.
He had an 82 OPS plus with two seasons in Colorado, so and the juice ball, so not good. No bueno.
But he could receive the ball. That's what's important. You guys ever seen an untucked button-down? They look bad. Why? Because they're not supposed to be worn that way. Thankfully, there's Untuckit, the original button-down shirt that actually is designed to be worn untucked. No matter your size, your shape, Untuckit shirts always fall at the perfect untucked length. With more than 50 fit combinations, Untuckit shirts look great on tall, short, slim, and athletic guys of all ages. I gotta tell you, one of my pet peeves is shirts that are too long, and you try to tuck it in and then pull it out a little bit. It's awkward. It looks bad. It's not a good look. I like these shirts because they are tailored beautifully and they look good tucked out. And that's a more casual look. That's the way I like to be. You can choose the styles from wrinkle-free button-down, super soft flannels, outerwear, and more. With Untuckit, your shirts will never look baggy, bulgy, too long, or too big again. And their website is so easy to use. They even have an entire page devoted to helping you find your fit. So whether you're shopping for that perfect gift or just trying to craft a smart, relaxed style of your own, Untuckit is the way to go. Visit Untuckit.com and use code BLUE for 20% off at checkout. That's Untuckit.com and promo code BLUE for 20% off.
We have some juicy sign-stealing scandal updates. The Athletic posted another 5,000-word article about the topic, and this time it's about the Red Sox, so obviously Yankees fans just lost their shit and started dunking all over Red Sox fans. I'm going to quickly summarize what's going on here, and then we can talk about it. So the 2018, there was three anonymous players with a 2018 team, might not be just players, people with the 2018 Red Sox team, said the Red Sox used the video replay room to figure out catcher sequencing signs, just like the Astros did. And what they would do is take that information to the dugout, discuss it amongst teammates, and then when a base runner would reach second base, he would be able to more quickly decipher the signs and relay those to the batter through traditional methods of touching a helmet, putting a hand on his hip, putting a foot on a bag, all the stuff that we already know goes on. And that's how they used the video replay room to steal signs. And the Red Sox now are being investigated.
So, I mean, they were doing it
much more smartly than the Astros were doing it, frankly.
Well, honestly, so when I first heard this, I was like, okay, how many teams are not doing this? That was my first yep. instinct, my first, very first instinct. How many teams are not doing this? Because I guarantee a lot of them are. And the thing is what makes the Astros so very, very different. And I know in the article they talk about cheating and then cheating, where you're looking at like, well, one guy's doing this, but this guy's doing this.
Yeah.
And there is a clear distinction. And for me, the biggest distinction is the timing. One is in real time. The other one is not in real time. And I understand that they have a distinct advantage going out to a bag with information, right? They're not having to decipher something or look at something while they're on the they're on the bag.
They still know the information, they know
what to look for.
It's basic what the Red Sox are doing. This is the analogy. What the Astros were doing is they got the answers to the test. Every answer, they got it in real time. What the Red Sox had is, okay, here's 100 answers, and we're going to ask you 50 of these questions. It might be one of these, so you're going to more quickly figure it out. Because they still had to go out there and see what signs were being put down, and then remember what the sequencing was that they saw on the video, and then in real time relay that to the batter.
So they also had to be there.
They had cheat notes, but they didn't have the answers to the test.
Right, but that's like having the cheat notes, but then, you know, sometimes not showing up on time for the test because you have to be on second base.
Right, you have to get on base in order to do this.
So you say 50 out of 100, it's not even that much. But the thing is a lot of times when a game, first of all, if a guy doesn't change their signs after a start, let's just say a start from a previous game, right? And they're looking at video because everybody does that and trying to pick up different things and what the guys did, different sequences, what they're doing. That's on them, right? That's on the pitcher for not changing his stuff up because the obviously there's minions going to find out what you're doing with video after the game and such. You know, this is very similar in the sense it's the same technology, the same process, but what it's doing now is it's getting to them a little bit quicker. It's getting to them in game. And now these guys, when they're on second base, they do have to view it. They have to be able to see what it is. They have to, I'm sure there's a few of them where they're testing, making sure that their system is correct. And then once they realize that it is, you know, they do the 1 foot on second base, looking out in the outfield or whatever the hell it is. Very lower key tells that are harder to pick up, I think, from an opposing team.
Well, so, that's how you relay signs when you just figure it out on the field. That's what you do to relay
yes.
signs.
Yes, but I think you're now in an opportunity where you could do everything's planned out. That's a little bit, I don't know, just a little bit more subtle. I think it's probably harder.
So I think you and I are going to be in agreement on this. The Red Sox are definitely exploiting the video replay room, which a lot of teams probably are, and that's against the rules. So technically, that's cheating. But this is not even in the realm of what the Astros were doing.
Right. No, it's.
Upset me that the Red Sox were doing this. It upset me that what the Astros were doing.
It was egregious.
This did not upset me because
what the Astros were doing was one of the most cocky forms of blatant cheating in everybody's face that I could possibly think of. I mean, it's so egregious and so goddamn arrogant that it's almost you think of the type of person that would be as arrogant as that to think that nobody's going to figure that out, because what they're doing is downright juvenile. They're banging a trash can.
Oh, no one would have figured out the Red Sox were doing this unless they had sources tell them.
Right.
Oh, I was there and we did this, because there's no possible way you would be able to figure out what they were doing.
What the Astros were doing was they were cheating in real time. It doesn't matter what the situation was in the field, because you don't have to have runners on base to know what's coming if there's a camera watching it from the eye in the sky at all times. That is insane to me. This, honestly, if I'm being very clear and honest with it, it's within my expectations of what teams were doing.
Yes.
Already.
When you have that room,
when you have that room right there,
that's a problem.
Freaking close. I don't know why it's there in the first place.
It should be removed. And I think MLB needs to address that. They've tried to address it with these in-stadium monitors, but even that didn't work last year. The article talked about how these guys would just leave their posts for innings at a time. Yeah. Or they could be bought, which they were.
Right.
So there are degrees of cheating, though. The Astros, they cheated on their spouse, and then they had another family, Bartolo Colon. The Red Sox maybe had an inappropriate text conversation with someone. Like, there's degrees here. I hope Leanne never listens to this segment. But there are degrees here. And yeah, the Red Sox are being investigated. Maybe they're doing more than what this article talked about. But there's some quotes in here, and I really think they're telling. The quote about the deer. So the player on the Red Sox was quoted, "It's really hard for anybody to get away with it at that point. If you got a lion and a deer, then the lion can really take advantage of the deer. So there are a lot of deer out there that weren't paying attention throughout the season. In the playoffs, now you're going against a lion." So basically they're justifying it with, "We know other teams are doing this because they have this technology too. It's in every stadium, 10 feet from every dugout. So are we going to be a lion or a deer?" That's the question you have to ask.
So there's a pretty interesting comparison here, because when you say it like that, when you say it in that analogy, and when you start thinking about what that analogy means, it's everybody else is doing it. So if you want to keep up with the Joneses, you got to do it too.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly what steroids was.
Yes.
It's exactly what steroids
was. Jose Canseco, for as much of a freaking moron he is, in his book, he said his best estimate is that 80 to 90% of players in Major League Baseball were doing some form of performance-enhancing drug during that era. Okay? I don't think he's that exaggerating that much. So I'm going to go
He's become the most trustworthy guy in that whole debacle.
If I had to guess, 80 to 90% of Major League Baseball teams were abusing the technology that was put in place in 2014 for the instant replays.
In some form or capacity, yes. In some shape
not
or way.
To the, yeah. Maybe not to the degree the Astros were doing it, but they were doing something, quote-unquote, against the rule book.
Yeah. No, I would be very surprised if we didn't see the majority of teams that had some type of, of nick against them for doing something that's, quote, illegal based on the guidelines set by MLB.
The guidelines were set in 2014 when they put the instant replay challenges became a thing. They put replay rooms where you could have a guy who would look at these replays and then yell down the hall to the manager, "Hey, challenge it." Right? That's the system they decided to go with. Okay. So now a player just struck out and he's like, "Damn, like I wasn't expecting the curveball there on that pitch. Let me walk down the hall and take a look at this. Oh, wow. High def live feed of, oh, the catcher just put down a 3, a 2, then a 1. Oh, what?" And then he threw the curveball. Okay. Let me figure out this sequencing. Hey, teammate, guess what I just figured out? Of course that's going to happen. How did MLB not know this was going to happen?
So side note,
it baffles me.
Side note, when I was in, whenever they taught reproductive health in school, what is that? It's in high school, right? Freshman year, something like that, whatever it is. My health teacher, who was the basketball coach, Jim Stroker at Ridgewood High, the way that he would talk about this is he would open the door to the classroom and scream down the hallways, "Fallopian tubes. Here come the eggs," to anybody who's in the hallway. Just scream at the top of his lungs down there. So that's what that made me think of.
That guy would not fly in today's society. No,
he was a bit of a loon. It was awesome, though. I'll never forget it.
So you got a gym teacher yelling down the hallway, hey, Boone, challenge it. He took
these
his
are
foot
tactics.
Off second base.
These are tried and true tactics from old school. Yeah, these exist. But
so
I mean,
they put the technology there and they're like dangling. It's like dangling
a
piece
boys.
Of meat.
Here it is.
It's dangling a raw porterhouse in front of a hungry dog.
It's just one of those things where you're looking at, and when you start comparing that and you make those comparisons to the steroids and the era and how that has dramatically. And you can identify players. I think the difference being is it's an individual decision for players versus now this is probably an organizational decision. This is something that's coming from the top down where if you're a player, it's coming to you. You're not making a choice to do this. This information is coming to you, so you can either use it or not use it. Even though you hear it, you cannot use it. So I think there's a very glaring difference when you're talking about the two things, where one's a very individual decision for cheating, and this one's more on the higher level. But if you look at them, they're similar in nature in the sense that you know it's wrong, but if you're not doing it, everybody else is doing that wrong thing, and they're going to have a significant advantage against you. And in this case, your team. Not your individual person.
Well, there was some quotes in the article, in the Athletic article, that said one of the quotes was an executive was quoted in saying players would come to a new team and then say, hey, you effing morons, you're not doing this.
Right.
What's wrong with you? Look, it's right here.
Everybody's doing it.
I have the answers to
it.
The test right
Everybody's
here.
Everybody's doing it.
And the Yankees, it was cited in the article, as far back as 2015, the Yankees used the video replay room to learn other teams' sign sequences, multiple sources told The Athletic. Okay. So it doesn't say that they were doing it after 2017, which is when they got a little slap on the wrist for inappropriately using the Yes Network cameras. That's when the Red Sox got a punishment for inappropriately using Apple Watches. Or not inappropriately, they were using Apple Watches, which is against the rules. You can't use technology
in the dugout.
So the Red Sox and the Yankees got in trouble. Manfred said, this is putting on notice to the rest of the league. We are cracking down on this. So we know you're doing something, but stop it. And no one stopped, obviously. And it was just the tip of the iceberg because meanwhile, in 2017, the Astros are slamming on trash cans and blowing whistles from behind home plate. So maybe the Yankees were good Samaritans, and then after their slap on the wrist, they said, guys, shut the replay room down. We're no longer doing this. We're going to follow the rules. I hope they did that, but I'm not naive enough to think they did that. Because are the Yankees a lion or a deer, Scott?
Well, I'd say that they're a lion, Andrew.
Yes, they're a lion, and I wouldn't want them to be a deer.
And the other thing you think about, too, like just think about the actual methods of breaking down video and looking for said signs. These are things that these guys did anyway. They're like, this happened. Again, like I said before, it happened post-game. It happened afterwards. Yeah. But I guarantee they had film guys looking through. So it's not like the practice of doing this was foreign to them. They knew how to do it. They knew what to look for. They knew how to zoom in.
How do you think players figure out a pitcher's tipping? How do you think you figure out tipping?
Your eyes.
It's watching the guy on video. Right?
What are you talking about? Because in game a lot of time there are definitely tells that people see.
No, right. But how do you know going into a game a guy has been tipping his pitches? It's because you've watched his last 10 starts and you notice that when Luis Severino has a runner on second base and he turns around and moves his head towards third base, he's throwing an off-speed pitch. You don't figure that out on the fly. You figure that out by pouring over thousands of pitches in video.
There are certain tells that you can figure out in game, and I think that does happen because some guys are just better at others than for picking up things like that. And I mean, that is the old way to do it. But yes, they're looking at video because they are allowed to. They look at video. It's on television. It's on now every device possible. The highlights. You don't have to go far. Not to mention they have, you know, way more access to different video than everybody else does. So there's just a plethora of video for them to watch afterwards. So this is just the practice of doing it in game.
And that's the part MLB wanted to avoid. That's why they said you can't use the replay room to view video during the game. Because if you can, most 99% of the time, teams change their sign sequencing from start to start and game to game. So just because the team X was doing this sign sequence on Friday, they're going to be using a different sequence on Saturday. So you can analyze the video post game all you want, but it's not going to help you for Saturday. But if you can figure it out in the fifth inning on Friday, well, then guess what? Now you have an advantage. And that's what MLB wanted to avoid. And they clearly opened up Pandora's box by putting these replay rooms just a few feet from the dugout. So the question is, how do you fix it? Because they implemented these in-person MLB regulated people to sit in the video room to monitor it, to make sure there's nothing shady going on. but these guys were being bought. They were just looking the other way. They were leaving for innings at a time.
Felt uncomfortable being intimidated. Like, yeah. There's a number of things that can happen.
So that's not going to fix it. Are you going to lock the door? What do you do? If there's a door, you're going to put a locked door on the room so no one can go in and out during the game?
You know,
there's only one way to fix it.
Yeah, go ahead. Because I already saw what you put in the notes, and there's just, to me, it's the most clear and obvious thing. And it goes way beyond what we're talking about.
So the reason these rooms are there is because there's now manager challenges. So what you do is you take the manager challenge away because it's stupid anyway, and you remove these rooms from down the hall from the dugout. You do one of two things. You put one of them in the stadium somewhere neither player from any team can get to, and you have an umpire or somebody else that MLB has deemed responsible enough to sit there, and if a call is missed, they radio down to the umpires and say, hey, morons, the guy's foot was off the bag, you got to fix it. Or it all happens in Chelsea, in MLB headquarters, and there's a whole team of people looking at every game for the night on instant replay. Everyone's assigned to a different game, and if an umpire messes up, they get a signal from headquarters saying, hey, morons, you missed it, fix it. None of this, hey, Bob, down the hall, did he take his foot off the bag? Yeah, Boone, he took his foot off the bag. Meanwhile, Boone's sitting there with his friggin' hand up. Hey, don't play yet,
Stalling the game.
I'm going to stall the game. Okay, no, I guess he didn't take his foot off the bag. You guys can go ahead. It's so stupid.
I don't understand. So football has this thing now where they challenge every single scoring play. It happens very fast. It happens in real time. There's nobody on the field doing anything. It's all coming from a place in the sky. It doesn't matter where it is, but it's in the sky. It's technology. It's telling them what to do, right? There's some nerd in a room looking at it. Or it doesn't even have to be a nerd. Could be somebody that actually knows what they're talking about.
Someone with common sense. Like, ideally, it's someone with common sense.
Well, nerds have common sense, and they know what they're talking about. That didn't come out right. But nerds are people, too. The thing is if you do have somebody on this, and there's a play that's close, why not just confirm it?
Right.
Confirm it.
Yeah.
It's not that the personnel, I got to believe, is already there. And what are you doing? Adding a couple people? They make enough money. Add some people in a room, make it a call center, make it like, you know, like you're calling like wherever for customer service. You have a call center, and what you're doing now is you're confirming the outs. Obviously, some of them don't really need to be confirmed because they're so clear as day. The majority of outs are like that. But when there's some kind of close call, remotely close, just confirm it.
And while we're at it, can we stop challenging if the guy slid into second base and was so obviously safe, but the guy kept the tag on and he may have raised his cleat a millimeter? Can we stop challenging those? Because the guy was safe, but he just happened to take his foot off the bag. And I don't want to spend 4 minutes looking at a replay to see if he took his foot off the bag for a split second. So let's just use common sense on what to challenge and what not to challenge. Was the ball fair? Was the ball foul? Was the ball caught? Did it hit the ground? Was the guy safe at first base or second base or whatever? Not, did he take his foot off the bag? So it's a lot of these things they can change, and I think it helps fix this particular cheating problem. There's going to be other cheating problems. It doesn't fix all cheating problems, but it fixes this cheating problem.
That is why cheating exists. People try to get in front of and ahead of systems. And that's what they're doing. They see something. They see a place to be exploited, an area to be exploited to gain an advantage. Cheating. And that will always happen. No matter how you change it, there will be other ways to exploit. And people will find them. Teams will find them. Players will find them. So you just need to, as far as baseball goes, keep up with the Joneses and keep up with the cheating, the waves of cheating so that you can actually... And these aren't even difficult.
No,
these
are not difficult. I'm getting so mad because it seems like such an easy fix.
It is an easy fix.
But why does MLB...
Other sports are currently doing it.
Why do they drag their feet on this kind of thing?
Yeah.
Like, seriously, why? So they implemented this in 2014. Here we are, 7 years later, and it's still happening.
It's one of those things, man. It's one of those things where baseball is just slow to move. It's always been that way. I don't know how. I don't know how you're ever gonna make baseball fast, a fast-moving sport that actually brings on new technologies in a timely fashion. But it seems like it's just like moving the Titanic for a long time.
So
big ships.
The Astros' punishments are reportedly going to come down any day now, and they're going to be severe. So the MLB has an opportunity to use this as a moment to not only punish the Astros severely, but say this cheating can no longer happen, not because we punish them severely, but because we're taking away the opportunity to cheat with it.
Yeah.
It's an easy thing to do. Punish the Astros severely, take away their draft picks, fine them, suspend Hinch, suspend players, suspend Cora, because obviously...
They're not going to suspend players. They've already talked about that. They're going to suspend the guys who are in charge of things,
okay,
which I agree with.
Suspend Cora, because clearly he had a heavy hand in both of these. He was the bench coach for one and the manager for another. Maybe fine or suspend Carlos Beltran, because I know he was a player at the time, so maybe he's not going to get anything. Come down as harsh as you possibly can, but then take away the opportunity to cheat, because it's still going to happen.
So the only thing that is giving me a little bit of hope, I should say, hope's probably not the right word, but maybe it is, that the Red Sox actually did more than this, is Alex Cora. I mean, he's clearly the guy that was the reason it was happening. I mean,
yeah,
he's
maybe
the guy
he looked
that came
at the Astros system and was like, they're going to get caught any day now. We got to be smarter about it. And frankly, they were smarter about it.
Or they were smarter about it, and there's still other things that haven't been talked about yet. Possible.
Maybe. Yeah.
That's the other thing about the Red Sox. There could be more of a fire with what's already come out. But
I'm worried
about
there's
been
a lot
of
shoe to drop, and I'm worried it's going to be something even more tied to the Yankees, because I know the headline had the Red Sox in it, but the Yankees were mentioned in that article like every other paragraph.
Yeah. We'll see, man. It's just one of those things. Like, I will certainly condemn the Yankees if it comes out that they did that first. It's not like just because it's a team I root for, I'm gonna turn a blind eye to it. It's not that at all. I don't want anybody to be doing this, because what it does is it hurts the game. And at this point, I just want a fun game, a clean game, people to play, and have some fair competition. If you don't have competition at the highest level, that's fair and gives everybody an opportunity, that's when you got problems with sports. That's why Lance Armstrong became the freaking poster boy for, basically ruining a sport. You have a guy that's playing with different set of rules than everybody else, a team that's playing with a different set of rules than everybody else. Now you're looking at a sport that's at the highest level with athletes who are at the best of their abilities, the highest level athletes, and you're giving other people a distinct advantage in calculated ways that have nothing to do with what their abilities say on the field. And that's a problem. And that's a problem for any sport.
So I saw a report that MLB is going to look into possibly implementing more on-field technology to help players be able to relay signs so electronically. So between a pitcher and a catcher, or between a manager and a player, or a coach, it's going to be some sort of sign sequencing with electronics, or some sort of random number generator with electronics. Some way so it would be harder for teams to decipher. But to me, that just opens up more possibilities to cheat.
Yeah, you're giving them more technology.
More technology to cheat. Just take away the technology you gave them already, and you fix it. So, I don't know.
It's not even taking away the technology. It's just adjusting the technology.
No,
to
you're
a point
still going
to
have replays. Yeah. Just
the technology is still there. You're just implementing it in a different way.
Right.
Just pivot, man. Just pivot.
Pivot. All right, let's move to mailbags. First up, Andrew C. He's a frequent submitter of mailbags. If the Yankees go on to win 100 games and cruise to the playoffs, do you guys see baseball industry giving Aaron Boone less credit as a coach and in-game manager this season as opposed to last year? Due to the big acquisition of Gerrit Cole and the presumption of better health throughout the team, fingers crossed on that one, the next man up theme may not be needed, and I can see baseball experts downplaying Boone's impact as a motivator and a leader. So as the Yankees are getting better, Boone's getting less and less credit, and I think that happens with any manager in baseball.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a real thing, and if he were to win manager of the year, if he was going to win manager of the year in any year of his career, it was last year.
Yep.
And he didn't win it, so I wouldn't expect him to win unless you're looking around the league and you're just not seeing anybody that's a candidate. Then in fact, it'll probably go to the best team and whoever leads that team. So there are certain circumstances that he will get, an award for it, but I do think that last year was one of those years that he deserved it and actually should have gotten it. But yes, now they're a better team, less that he needs to do, another year under the belt with these guys, and another year under the belt for him. So yeah, I think it's Andrew's mailbag's pretty on point.
Torrey won it twice in 96 and 98. 96, unexpected team, goes on to the playoffs and ends up winning a championship. 1998, the best team of all time. Right. So maybe if the Yankees win 125 regular season games this year, Boone will win it. But if they just win 103 or 105, win the division, go to the playoffs, he's not going to win it.
Right. No, he would have to do something extraordinary for him to win it. And
I don't really care, but I do think Boone... I think Boone took a lot of good steps forward in his second year as manager.
Absolutely. I think he... You know, I think year one... People were critical of him in certain ways, but I do think that, you know, it was a big year for him to figure out his players and figure out his style and what he's going to do with in certain situations. And then now you have year two, you got a lot more, you know, muscle memory. You have a lot more situations already in your head. I mean, the experience from 1 year in the big league, sitting on that bench, making those decisions is priceless. I don't care how many people you ask. I don't care how many times you were in the dugout as a kid and how many other, you know, dugouts you've been in as a player. It's not the same when you're actually calling the shots and having those conversations in game, making those decisions in game. It's different. And yeah, 1 year under the belt makes a world of difference. And I think it's just now him tweaking his style.
All right. Next up is from Josh. Last episode, you guys said Glaber has the best chance to win the MVP award on the team. Does this mean he has taken over as the best, most important player from Judge?
So this is an interesting conversation, actually. I was just thinking about this when we were talking about, or when we were setting up the, you know, the Judge arbitration talks, because in theory, you could actually look at, and Judge is still the face of this team. There's no doubt about it, but Glaber ain't far behind. And now that Didi has carved has left town, and there's a spot carved out for Glaber, and it's a good spot. It's the shortstop spot of the New York Yankees, like the spot. I'd say shortstop and center field of the New York Yankees are two of those positions that are just like limelight follows those spots. If you're a superstar player, you play for the New York Yankees and you're a center fielder or you're a shortstop, chances are you're going to be a very high profile guy if you're playing well. So Glaber, with the youth behind him, with the ability that he has behind him, with his likabilities, there's just a lot of things that really do push him into that spot. And best chance to went off track with like who he is, but yeah, I think that it does take away from Judge a little bit in the sense that he's becoming as important, and I think that's a very real conversation.
Well, I think best and most important can be different. Was Derek Jeter always the best player on the Yankees?
No,
but he was the leader. He was the captain.
Yeah,
he was the face of the team.
Yep,
and he was one of the best players on the team, and I think that's what we're going to have with Judge. Like, Glaber might be the most talented. He might put up better numbers next season. He might not. We said he has the best chance to win the MVP. I think I said it for a couple of reasons. One, shortstops, I think, that can hit potentially 40 home runs get a little bit of an extra edge than a right fielder who can hit 40 home runs. He will have better defense next year at shortstop than he did second base. Judge has missed time, so he's likely to miss time next year. Whereas Glaber, I know, not the most healthy, durable guy, but better chance to play 150 games than Judge. So
there's going to be more pressure on him, too, to play. I think we're going to see him, you know, at that, because he's now the starting shortstop, we're going to see, you know, that's a guy that you're not going to take out. And another year older, like, your body's used to playing a longer season at this point. I think we're going to see him really become an everyday guy, you know, obviously if he could stay on the field and not be hurt. And a couple of years ago when we saw those injuries with the hip and then he kind of tailed off towards the end, I think that was, you know, more of a fluky type thing. But yeah, he's still got a lot to prove. There's no doubt about it, but he is definitely on the path to being, you know, one of the most productive players on this team.
I liked that question too, because he kind of backed us into a corner.
Yeah, but it's also... It's just interesting because when you have, I mean, theoretically, you look around the team and you have Stanton, you have Judge, you have Gary Sanchez, who could be all world again, Gleyber Torres. Like, you have these guys who are all prolific players. They're all extremely, DJ LeMahieu, who's not the type of like glitz and glamour guy by any means, but he is right there as far as production. Mm-hmm. So you have these guys that they're multiple players that are playing at such a high level. It's really hard to say which one is the most important or which one is the best, because they're all good for different reasons too. So Yeah, it's a fun conversation because there's really not one good answer. There's a bunch of good answers.
Yeah, you could have the argument though that losing Glaber would be more detrimental to the 2020 Yankees than losing Judge because of who they have behind each of those players. Who's the shortstop if Glaber Torres goes down? Yeah. Right now it's Tyler Wade. Who's the right fielder if Aaron Judge?
Or Tyro, it could be Tyro Estrada. Tyro Estrada might have an opportunity to step up and show what he's got.
Yeah, the outfield has some depth issues too because of injury, but you know, if Judge does go down and Stanton's on the field, he plays right field. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you could argue for
Glaber. You want your starting shortstop to be a mainstay in the lineup. There's no doubt mm-hmm. about it. So it's a highly pivotal place for him to be. I mean, shit, DJ LeMahieu could walk over to shortstop and play Gold Glove. I have no doubt.
All right, next up is from Yehuda Kirschenbaum. Do you think the Nationals are a good and logical trade partner for Miggy? If so, who are the targets in their organization? So, Andujar. Obviously, the Nats lost Rendon. He was their third baseman, so they do have an opening at third base, and they have replaced Rendon with a bunch of infielders. Cabrera, Castro, Thames, Kendrick have all signed or re-signed with the Nationals this winter. So they're going to go, I guess, third baseman by committee.
Don't they have a kid too coming up? I thought they had a young guy too that was ready to take a leap as well.
I'm not familiar with.
It's funny because Starlin Castro was one of the when he was on this team, and we were very excited about him, and we were looking at you know what was going to happen and who was going to move around, and when they got when they had people to play at second base, we looked at Castro, and I know I remember saying this was that. You know, he played shortstop. He played second base. Like I could definitely see him playing third base. He's got the body. He's got the ass for third base to get over there, and he's got the fielding ability to get over there and play some third base. So I wouldn't be surprised if he went over there.
Yeah, he's still surprisingly not old.
Because he was up when he was 12 with the Cubs.
And I know he's on like hit pace is up there with the all time leaders as for like games or age because he's played so many games. And I just find it funny that Starlin Castro is a free agent and he's signing like garbage contracts for 1 year with the Nationals. Whereas if Starlin Castro at 29 years old, which is what he is, became a free agent and he had 1,600 hits, which is what he has, if he was a free agent in like 1997, he'd sign like a $150 million contract.
Yeah. Yeah, no, did he finish the season with the Marlins last year? Did he finish the season or was he hurt?
I think so. I don't know.
I don't know what the hell happened down there, but he was
lost track of him once he was no longer with
the Marlins. Yeah, man, it was sad. That's still why we play the song underneath the Omega song underneath the voicemails when we do voicemails. That was Starlin Castro's walk-up song when he was with the Cubs.
Yeah.
And I was just very hopeful that he was going to bring that over and the whole stadium
was
going to go nuts.
We were so desperate for like anything at that
energy.
Point.
Yeah. I was like really hoping it was going to be that. That's
sick so of watching Chase Headley go to the plate.
It's stuck ever since.
Is it realistic that Andujar gets traded to an NL team?
Yeah, I think it's realistic. I think it's definitely realistic. I think that, again, you know, we're making... I know he was not good when he played third base, but he was also a rookie. The guy was a rookie.
Yeah, but he wasn't just not good.
There are plenty of cases where a guy that is... When you're looking at why he was bad and you're looking at the footwork, that's fixable. You can fix those things.
That's true.
If he's able to go around and fix that footwork and be able to just have better approach, and again, we've said this 100 times, be an average guy, then yeah, there's significant value there because the bat is so good. So yes, I think there's a maturation process for a player like Miggy, and he could certainly be a better player. You know, it's like as you get older with things, you buckle down and you start focusing on things a little bit different. I think... That it could be this year. It could be anytime it clicks. He's got the ability to do it. That's for sure.
So I don't see the Yankees trading Andujar right now. But if they were to, I would imagine it would be for a player they can use on the major league roster immediately, not someone that they have to wait on prospect status wise. You agree?
I don't know because there's just so many. There aren't very many spots where you could bring someone over and improve the team.
That was
for a guy like Miggy with that talent.
Well, that's how I looked at it because Yehuda asked if so, who are the targets in their organization? And I was like looking at their major league team. It's like, well, who on this team would the Yankees want to acquire for Andujar? And nobody stood out to me. And I don't know anything about their organization, like minor league wise, to even throw out a guess as far as like what prospect the Yankees would ask for. Like, just go look at their top 10 prospects and ask for a couple of those, I guess. I don't know. But Adam Eaton kind of intrigued me. He's 30.
Why would you do that if you're the Washington Nationals when you have a team that just won the World Series and you have a guy like Adam Eaton who is a very good player, plays with that team well, and you don't know. Like, I do believe that Andujar could be a better fielding third baseman, but you don't know that until it happens.
No, I'm not saying they would. I guess if they loved Andujar and said, this is our third baseman for the next decade, like, let's take a chance at this now. But I don't know. He just intrigued me because he is 30 and he's had injuries recently, but he played healthy last year and he's reasonable salary for the next 2 years. So that intrigued me. And he's a left-handed hitter outfield. Joe Ross is a buy low pitcher. He has regressed every year he's been in the majors, but he's only 26. Get Matt Blake and the team of nerds on him. Maybe they can improve him.
I mean, Lucas Giolito was that guy. He was he fell apart. He fell off the face of the planet after they traded. And in fact, they traded him for Adam Eaton. He was those two guys were centerpieces for that deal.
And Giolito was good to the White Sox.
And Giolito was nasty last year, but he had a very, very, very big fall from grace, as he was the number one prospect in all of baseball before the trade happened. So when that trade happened, I looked at it, I was like, what are we doing here?
They just traded the
number one prospect in baseball, who's a lefty pitcher, or is he a right?
No, he's a right-handed pitcher.
He's a right-handed.
But when have you ever seen a team trade the number one prospect in baseball when it's a starting pitcher? Like, you never see that happen.
No, the last time I remember something like that happening, and I think he was a prospect at that time. Who was it? It was when Josh Hamilton was traded for...
Castillo. Right?
Not Castillo. It's this dude's still in the league, though. I think he was with the Royals for a minute. He was with the Royals when they won the World Series, I think, at the end. I can't think of his name. He was with Texas. Anyway, it was the Texas and the Cincinnati trade. And what's his name? It's going to piss me off.
I'm going to look
But he was, I think he was one of the top prospects.
I know exactly who you're talking
about. Yeah. I could see his face. I just can't think of his name. But that's the last time I can remember off the top of my head, you know, when two big guys were traded. And Hamilton obviously had a lot of things that he was coming back from at that point, but man, that worked out pretty well for them with Texas for a little bit.
It worked out for both teams actually, because the Reds got a good pitcher.
You still can't find his name?
Yeah, it's loading. It's on Baseball Reference. It's loading. So I don't know. I just, again, I know I've said this 1,000 times. I don't expect Edison Volquez. So no, not a C. I don't see the Yankees trading Andujar now. It just doesn't make sense, I don't think. But
I think there's, again, we kind of mentioned this with him and Frazier last time we were doing 20 questions, is at this point when you're looking at it, unless somebody overvalues them and they get to a point where, you know, you think that the value is close to what you think that player should be, then it's not in Brian Cashman's best interest to do that. Clint Frazier can be in the minor leagues and play, I mean, Miggy could too, theoretically. Like, you could see them both, you know, having time to figure out their stuff, or at least figure out what kind of player they are at this point. And I think at that point, as long as they're not, you know, a shell of themselves, which I don't expect either one of them to be, then your value is significantly higher if you wait.
The last question from Live for the Day on Twitter. Their handle is @DJBirdM4N. It's crazy how the Yankees got Cole and then went radio silent. I know they don't have many holes to fill in the roster, but there is still work for this team to do, and they are sitting on their damn hands. It's not really a question, more of a statement. I turned it into a question, and I put out a Twitter poll. If the Yankees could make one more significant move, what would it be? I asked infield, outfield, starter, or bullpen. 44% of people said bullpen. That was the leader. 25% said starter. 18% said infield. 12% said outfield. And I also asked the Bronx Pinstripes team, and they voted bullpen as well. So you guys agree with Twitter, which I think is a little concerning.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's one of those answers that, again, you're looking around and you're seeing what could you acquire that will make you that much better. And, you know, to me, the only natural place that you could really just make a splash and still put the puzzle piece in with no issues is the bullpen.
That's why I think you guys answered it. It's because it's the easiest place to add.
Before we do this, real quick, Volquez was one of their top prospects at that point, and he had only made six starts with the Rangers the year before. So it was a similar, similar trade in that sense.
Yeah, good memory on that one.
The flashes of memory come in my head occasionally.
Yeah, you remember the thing. You just didn't remember all the details. It's fine. So bullpen, you can add a bullpen piece and not have to take away. That's that's why I get why people answered that. But whether the Yankees add another bullpen piece or not, they're going to have one of the best bullpens in baseball. All big five are coming back. Chapman, Britton, Ottavino, Canely, Green, all coming back. The Yankees had the second best bullpen according to WAR last year, behind only the Rays. 7.6 WAR to 7.5 WAR, essentially the same.
Right.
The Yankees are returning all their big guys, so they're going to have a
except
great
except for Betances, who obviously wasn't on the eight pitches. On the team.
Yeah. So I wanted the Yankees to bring back Betances because I do think that makes the bullpen that much better. And I think adding like Josh Hader makes the bullpen that much better. But am I going to trade away top prospects to get Josh Hader to add to already a strength of the team? In a blog I wrote today, I said it's like adding NOS to a Ferrari. It's fun, but you don't need to do it.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, though. It's different because that guy could still play a very pivotal role in a big game.
Sure.
I mean, so when you're adding to other places, you have to take a guy out, and now you're looking at what could have been if you kept that one guy in, or, you know, but in theory now you're looking at, if we're talking Josh Hader, let's just do it for conversation's sake.
Yeah.
Josh Hader or who? Or, you know, that's not a big name that is going to be fighting for the spot.
No, so I said meaningful move. So ideally it's someone that plays.
But that's
I didn't have an answer
where
who
are they
it was.
Playing?
So I said starter is where I would add. Okay. And I understand the rotation for next year looks set. Cole, Severino, Paxton, Tanaka, Hap or Montgomery or Luis Sessa or Michael King or Jonathan Loaisiga. Like, I get it. But, like, are they all going to stay healthy? Are they all going to be good?
They currently have depth right now, and they have guys under contract. J-Hap's going to be the guy unless there's a complete implosion or they trade him. J-Hap's probably going to be that guy. Jordan Montgomery probably going to start in AAA. That's what's going to happen, most likely. I mean, if you're looking at the tea leaves and what's happening right now and the roster as it's currently constructed, that's what it looks like is going to happen. So there is depth. They have depth.
Yeah.
The problem is, this is the same thing a couple years ago when we're looking at a starter. If you're going after a high leverage starter, then you got to sit somebody.
I'm okay with that as planes fly over your house. Because the Yankees, I know the question was specifically for 2020, but I'm also thinking about 2021 when Tanaka and Paxton are not guaranteed to be on the team.
Yeah, that's fair.
And Hap won't be on the team because I don't expect them to let the option vest. So as we sit here today, the Yankees have two starting pitchers who they know will be in the rotation in 2021, Cole and Severino. All the others are not a sure thing. They might re-sign Tanaka. They might re-sign Paxton, Michael King, or
Montgomery
Sessa,
is pretty
or
safe.
Montgomery could all progress and they could all turn into great starters, but that's not a sure thing.
Right. I mean, Montgomery, I think, is more of a sure thing in the sense that we've seen it already on the major league level.
Yeah.
He's been productive.
If I'm betting, I'm saying he's in the rotation, but it's not for certain.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, you could do it. It's just you're going to have a lot of guys vying for a fifth spot, and then you're paying a guy, J-Hap, $17 million a year to do nothing.
Yeah, and so maybe that doesn't make sense.
Because you're then making him a reliever, and does that make you better? No.
No, and I think the bullpen will also benefit from the better starting rotation. They're not going to have to throw a ton of innings this year because their rotation's better.
I'm going to say a crazy thing here. And I don't know why people aren't really looking at this more, honestly. If we're talking about the fifth starter, a number five starter, because that's what we're talking about, number five starter, not the number one, not the number two, not the number three, not even the number four, five, fifth guy, last guy in the rotation, if that's not clear enough, I want that guy to eat innings, stay in a game, doesn't have to be a gold glove, doesn't have to be a Cy Young guy, doesn't have to be a guy that is going to be going out and dominating teams. I need a guy to eat some innings, to give a little bit of a reprieve so that the bullpen is not destroyed on that day, even though theoretically that's when you're going to use your bullpen most. I need that guy to get some innings. And to me, if I'm looking around at all these guys, the one guy that clearly stands out as that guy who could be an innings eater, veteran type present in the number five spot is J-Hap. I don't know he's such an egregious pick to have as your number five starter, because we got him as a number three starter. Yeah, now he's the number five.
The beautiful thing, though, about the Yankees rotation for 2020 is that if they do need to have their rely on their bullpen for the fifth starter, they can, because Severino and Cole should be there to not have to do that. Quote unquote, knocking on wood.
We'll see.
Last year,
the nerds let them get through the seventh inning. Let's see if that happens. I can already tell you that that's going to be the one thing that's going to piss me off this year more than anything.
Yeah, when Garrett Cole gets pulled in the sixth inning with 97 pitches, I'm going to lose my goddamn mind.
Yeah.
But last year, there was no Severino, who should have been that guy. Paxton was a six-inning pitcher. Tanaka was a five, maybe six-inning pitcher. Hap, they wanted to get out of the game ASAP, and they went with an opener the other parts of the game. And Herman was a five- or a six-inning guy. Everyone was a five- or a six-inning guy.
Yeah.
It's okay if it's two or three. Or even, it's okay if it's two or three of your pitchers. But if you have two times through the rotation, six plus, seven plus, that helps everybody.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I like a veteran guy who made, you know, pretty drastic improvements in the second half of last year, like J-Hap, going into this year as the fifth starter guy. Again, we have not seen diminished stuff. We saw diminished production, but, you know, I'll say it again. Like the dude was much better in the second half. He made adjustments. We'll see if he can make those adjustments again. We'll see if those could stick. We'll see if the league hasn't made adjustments to him. We'll see if the ball is the same. We'll see all of these things. But it's not a bad spot to be in with J-Hap as your number five guy. With all those other guys that you mentioned, ready to pounce if he sucks.
Yeah. So I just want to mention some other replies we got from Twitter. So at SeanNYY3 says, Yankees were near the bottom of the league in infield DRS. So I guess he voted for infield, and they were. So adding a defensive glove could help. At Cradley said, sign a defensive first infielder that can play shortstop and second base. That may be Wade, but a solid proven veteran can play both would be great. DJ is a solid glove at second base, and he can play third and first. But really could use some depth at shortstop. But he said that might be just Wade, and I agree.
Wade's probably the best shortstop in the organization defensively. One of, if not the best.
No, I'm more than confident that he can play a defensive shortstop in the major leagues. So if you're just signing,
you're not going to find somebody better than
him. If you're just signing a defensive infielder, well, then don't. You have Tyler Wade.
Yes.
At the great one 2142 says Puig. That'd be wild. At Moniz Brian NYY, lefty in the lineup could help. @ATACH77. I know everyone's going to say bullpen, but if we get a free wish, it has to be another solid starter. So I'm with him. Last one @EricPepper. Do we need anyone? Maybe just use the money to create an extra gate for fans to get into the stadium on time.
That's the best answer. That is the best answer.
Does not matter if you go to a Tuesday night game, but when you go to a playoff game, yes, it does matter.
That's hilarious. That's a good answer. Now, yeah, let's open up another gate. That's fine. Funnel us in a different way. Please, can you hurt us better? Hurt us better.
All right. Thanks to the mailbags, everyone. We are going to get into out of left field now.
And that out as Sanchez destroys that to left field.
There it goes. Deep to left. Really deep.
In the air to left field. Back at the track at the wall. We are tied.
I pissed on a public building.
Yeah.
Hey, Scott. Well, let me ask you a question. When is the cutoff for you for wishing people a happy new year?
I don't really have a hard cutoff. So what I do is it depends on when I see the person, depends what time it is in the month, I'd say. If I'm like past, if I'm 2 weeks into the year, it's done.
We're approaching that. So right now it's the 10th of the month, 10th of January. Yeah. And I'm past my cutoff.
Yeah. It depends. I'm kind of sick of saying it. I don't really have a hard deadline, but I probably wouldn't say it to somebody right now.
Like it said, you say,
I said,
oh, it depends.
I said it to somebody yesterday. Two days ago, I said it to somebody.
You said it depends when I see them. So obviously, if you see them for the first time on the 4th, you're probably going to say it. But if you see them for the first time on the 14th, you're probably not going to say it.
No, I probably would not say it on the 14th, no.
Yeah. Because it's just something that, because I'm this type of person, it annoys me. Because like everyone, you go back to work after the new year, everyone's happy new year this, happy new year that. I had one guy say it to me twice at work.
Did you say something to him?
I was so close to saying it to him. I was like, dude, you said happy new year last week. You don't need to say it to me again.
As he gets angry. Listen.
I know you're just trying to be nice, but it annoys me. Listen, your kindness annoys me.
If you're trying to stop something, you need to speak up about it. And that doesn't mean...
I'm way too passive aggressive for that.
That doesn't, that doesn't mean scream about it on a podcast.
No, that's how I vent. This is how I get my anger out.
You need to stop these things in real life, out in the wild, out in the jungle. If you see somebody doing something egregious like that, you need to end it. You can't be one of those guys that just looks the other way and then goes and gets behind your keyboard and gets mad.
Would you say something? Would you say, "Hey, person, you know, thank you, but you know, you did say Happy New Year to me last week."
Yes,
you would say that.
Oh yeah. And I'll tell you why. I try to live my life, and I don't try to do it.
This is a Seinfeld moment. Like, this is just a Curb Your Enthusiasm moment.
Larry David is like, for whatever reason, I am very mentally aligned with him. These things piss me off.
But
so
Larry David's worth $1 billion. He can say whatever the hell he wants.
Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm. He wants off. It doesn't. He had. Do you think Larry David has any consideration for his bank account when he's saying any of these things?
So
he doesn't give a shit if he's the most powerful person on the planet. He's still going to say it. If he's homeless on the street, he's still going to say it. That's just who he is.
Have you heard his quote? It's one of my favorite Larry David quotes. And he said this 1,000 times, but they have asked him, "Is that really you?
Yes.
That you play on Curb Your Enthusiasm? Is that really you?" He goes, "It's the person I wish I was."
Oh, but I've seen him do things.
It's an exaggerated version of himself.
Yes,
it's him. But maybe he takes it a step farther than he would actually in society, because we are living in a society, Scott. We live in a society.
So what I think sometimes is, if I'm like characterizing what that character is and he says it's who he wants to be, I'd say it's Larry David's inner monologue. Mm-hmm. So Everything that he does on the show, he definitely already thinks and is in his brain, because obviously it came out in a script somewhere. This is a crazy man who has written all of these things. Like, Jerry Seinfeld was riding the coattails of Larry David on the show Seinfeld.
Come on, that's not fair.
Oh, it's totally fair. I love Jerry Seinfeld, don't get me wrong. But if there's no Larry David, Seinfeld is not what we think it is today. Not even close.
Okay, that's not fine, but if there's no Seinfeld, if there's no Jerry Seinfeld, Larry David doesn't have the opportunity to create the show either. Like, you're not going to like this comparison, but it's Brady Belichick. Everyone's saying like, "Oh, who's more important, Tom Brady or Bill Belichick?" I don't know the answer to that, but they're not where they are today without each other.
Fine. But the thing is that Jerry Seinfeld, when you look at, if you look at some of his old stand-up, we're not laughing at half that stuff.
Okay.
If we don't know who he is today.
But stand-up is hard to go back. It's very
stand-up
in the
is
moment.
What you, but it's also, you know, at that point, when I'm thinking what he was probably was a guy that was writing a lot of his own stuff. And yes, he did write a lot of the stuff for Seinfeld as well. They were both in the same room. And I think that's a dynamic that you can't say one is better than the other, because when you're in a room going off of somebody else's energy and you guys are making jokes together, like it probably doesn't come to fruition. Jokes don't land as well as unless you have both guys in the room. So I get that. I totally get that. And I'm not really here to say that. But what I'm saying is that the guy, the orchestrator, the puppet, the puppeteer is Larry David. Larry David is a genius.
You may have just opened up a can of worms.
Larry David's the genius behind that show. It is. He is.
I don't disagree with you, but I think you're also not giving Jerry Seinfeld enough credit.
Jerry Seinfeld gets a lot of credit. He's the guy that done it. But you know what? What it goes back to is that my mom used to have such a problem with this. She used to hate it all the time. And I never really had a big problem with it. But after she would pick it out all the time, I would always notice it. He's always laughing. He's always laughing, like, not trying to laugh, but
no,
like, just because.
Laughter. It's fake laughter.
No. There are certain lines that he says where he can't say it with a straight face because he's laughing. Kind of like a guy does on Saturday Night Live where he can't keep a straight face. And
Talking specifically about his acting in the show. I thought you were talking about him now as a person.
No, I'm talking about his acting in the show.
Yeah, he's not a good actor. He's admitted that.
Yeah, he would laugh and it would piss my mom off so much when he would do that. And it would bother me when guys would do it on Saturday Night Live. Like, what's his face? Would do it all the time on Saturday Night Live. And I couldn't stand him.
What's his face? I don't know.
The late night.
One of thousands guys.
The late night host. on NBC. Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah, Jimmy Fallon would laugh through sketches all the
time. Jimmy Fallon would laugh through sketches all the time. And I could not stand Jimmy Fallon on Saturday Night Live because all he would do was Adam Sandler bits. He would just like live off of Adam Sandler's bits. And it would piss me off because I was a big Sandler guy. Still am. Always a big Sandler guy. So I like him now actually as a host on The Tonight Show way better than I liked him on Saturday Night Live. So yeah, that.
Okay, well, we got there from when to cut off wishing someone a happy new year. My cutoff, I think, is so I cut it off after the first week back of work, and it just so happened to be like January 3rd or 4th because the new year came on a Wednesday. I went back to work on Thursday and Friday. After Friday, I'm not wishing people a happy new year anymore.
Here's what I can't wait for, because this is going to happen. Oh, Andrew, I haven't seen you since the new year, probably. Happy new year. And it's going to be like February 1 because well, you're leaving for 2 weeks to go out of the country right now. So
I'm also going to get 1,000 people wishing me happy new year on Twitter after this, which is fine. But
there are people definitely going to be doing this in real life because they hadn't seen you in the week afterwards. And then you were gone for a long time. So I can't wait for those people to come up all like really excited to say it. And like, oh, I haven't seen it. I can wish one more person a happy new year. And you're just going to get mad. And you better say something.
One of my favorite Francesa clips that Funhouse account put out was there was like a call in like late March. And the guy wishes Francesa a happy new year. And it like takes Francesa like a second or two to register what he just said to him. He's like, wait, it's March. What are you doing? It's March. We're here. So talking about March Madness. You wishing me a happy new year? So yeah. Hilarious. February. No, definitely got to cut it off at least end of January.
I'm just saying it's going to happen because of this situation.
If someone
and I love it.
Wishes
I'm definitely
me a happy
really
new
happy
year,
for this.
If someone in person wishes me a happy new year after February, like February 1st or later, I will say something to them.
Once you get back from your trip.
Okay, that's essentially February 1st.
Whatever that date is, yes, then you need to say something. And record it, please.
All right. That's going to do it. Any last words? I'm not going to be here for the next two episodes. We have a special episode. I'm going to tease it, not say what it is. We have a special episode that's going to come out on January 21st. It's already been recorded, and we have a very exciting set of videos that are coming out around then, too, about somebody who may or may not be inducted into the Hall of Fame this year. So you can probably guess what it's about. But other than that, Scott, you're going to have a different co-host on for the next couple weeks.
Yep. I will man the ship. We will not burn it down. We will continue on and have a good time in New Zealand, right?
New Zealand.
Hopefully there's no disruptions. I don't know what – I know those wildfires out in Australia are pretty bad, and I know they're neighbors, so hopefully
– Yeah, there was a crazy picture that I saw the other day taken from New Zealand in the North Island, and the sky is just orange, obviously, because of the fires.
Scary, man. It's scary stuff out there. I just watched that Netflix thing on California because I watched it because I didn't really grasp – I wanted to watch it because I don't think I definitely grasp like the how quick that stuff happens because you know we're not around it fires like large forest fires like they have in California and apparently Australia, but man that shit is absolutely crazy how fast it happens and how you know all of a sudden you're good and then like you know a couple minutes later you are not good.
Yeah,
it's scary stuff that's happening in Australia right now.
Yeah, every region just deals with different things. Like we look at that and it's absolutely terrifying. Whereas someone in Southern California looks and it's like Buffalo that one time got like 7 feet of snow in a matter of like 3 days and people were just buried in their houses and they look at that and they're like, oh my god. So
yeah, a lot of different things.
Wild
well, have
stuff.
Fun, man. Have a good time.
Thank you. I'm sure I'll tweet out a few pictures and stuff like that. So make sure to follow me. And Scott, talk to you in a couple weeks.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it. And go Yankees.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.